This is Inkstuds on CITR 101.9 FM, radio show where we talk about comics. My special guest today is John Kirschbaum.
Hi, Robin.
Do I pronounce properly, John?
That's it.
Kirschbaum. Excellent. And John's new book is Petey and Pussy, a tragic tale of of one bird in life with a dog and a cat.
Yeah.
And twatwurst.
Yeah, that seems to resonate with people. I'm not sure why.
You put it on the cover.
But, well, but, you know, on the cover you don't really know what it is, even though I did add a little drip coming off of it. I'm not sure if people will notice that. But, yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there. You have to look close.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book from our good friends at Fantagraphics.
Yeah, and Jacob Covey did a great job with the design and the cover. I was really, really happy with it. And it was kind of the first experience I've had with sending stuff out and saying, go ahead. You know, I used to do pretty much everything myself. So it was a little bit of a learning curve on letting go and letting him just do what he's... But I was really happy with it. I think it looks really nice.
He's super talented. And actually, I know he was really hyped about this project because he actually sent me in advance the first chapter. Like, dude, you got to check this out.
That's great.
Little on the sly thing occasionally.
Yeah, yeah. That's great.
And so I was like, oh, this looks good. So
yeah, they've been really great. Very helpful. And yeah, I've been really pleased with it. So.
So tell me a bit about Petey and Pussy. Where do they come from?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm gonna be vague on years because I just frankly don't remember. But it was quite a while ago that through a friend of a friend, I got hooked up with someone and an editor. And again, I can't remember this guy's name either. But they were going to sort of relaunch an old sort of Mad style. Magazine, and I think it was from DC at the time. Like, it was going to be, you know, under their guise, I guess, but I can't remember the name of it, and it never came to fruition. But I went and I met the editor, and he had said to me, you know, you do whatever you want, he says, but I think it'd be in your best interest to come up with some characters, which was something I really didn't do. You know, I hadn't done it in the Wiggly Reader or any of my previous stuff, having like a reoccurring set of characters. But he said, you know, it's going to be creator-owned. You'll own your copyright, and it's in your own best interest to come up with some characters. Maybe they'll catch on, and you can, you know, roll them into something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, good idea.
That's decent. Yeah.
And his only other request was that I not do anthropomorphic animals. Well, no. In particular, he did not want, and I'll leave out the cursing, but he didn't want any of those human beings with animal heads. It was like a pet peeve he had. He was like, you know, just don't want that stuff.
Like hep cats.
Which, like what?
Hep cats.
I don't know what that is, but yes, exactly
it's
like that.
It's an alternative comic from the 90s that disappeared into obscurity, and all the characters were human with these animal
heads. Yeah, well,
heads.
I mean, it's a very common, you know, he was like, don't. So, you know, I came home, and I'm sitting down thinking, and it was kind of the first thing, well, if he doesn't want that, maybe he'd like this. And, you know, that's sort of where they came from. I just drew up a couple of strips, and he liked them, but again, the project never came to fruition, so I made a little mini-comic out of those original strips, and then eventually put a short story into one of the Wrigley Readers, and then spun that off into an issue of P.D. and Pussy comic, all of which I published all of those myself. So, but that's really about it, and I've enjoyed doing it. I got a lot of good response from it. So I think they really are the only sort of reoccurring characters I do at this point. It's not a very exciting story, I'm afraid, but that's where they came from. I was just sort of being cheeky, and but it would be funny to, and I think he did appreciate, actually, the humor and the fact that I had done sort of almost what he asked me not to do. But anyway.
I think they can probably be described as like a couple of cantankerous middle-aged men.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I haven't given like a lot of, I don't give like a lot of thought to what it is that makes them do what they do. You know, I didn't set out to say, oh, I'm going to comment on middle-aged men or how people are sort of like animals sometimes. And obviously that's sort of what just happens because they are part human and they are part animals, and they succumb to both of those tendencies. They do a lot of animal things, and then they cozy up to a bar and they have a few drinks too sometimes. So
well, it doesn't feel like a social commentary at all.
So, oh, well, thank God.
We'll stick away from that. It just feels like a silly comic.
Yeah, that's good.
About,
that's really all it's intended to be.
You know, and it's as a silly comic should be, different layers of ridiculousness that permeate throughout.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it.
Well, I do try and like to layer stuff a lot. I mean, I put a lot of effort into trying to make it dense so that you can maybe even read it a couple of times and every time get a little something. I don't know if you noticed the drip on the cover, but, you know, I'm hoping after... After, you know, you go back to a couple times, you're like, oh, wait, you know, one of those type of things. I like trying to deliver that type of subtle, undertone to the comics. But
let's talk a little bit about what got you into comics. I have a feeling you read your fair share of Mads as a young man.
Oh, I did. Yeah, that was a big influence. I think probably my biggest single cartoonist influence was probably Don Martin.
Mm-hmm.
I liked his stuff a lot, and I read a lot of Mad, and I flirted with some superhero comics. I was into Spider-Man for a little while, but never really caught on to those. I sort of, you know, went toward the humor stuff, and as I grew a little older, and I started getting a subscription to National Lampoon. I probably wasn't more than like 13 or 14 years old at the time, maybe even younger, and I was getting National Lampoon delivered to the house, and, you know, there's naked women in it and everything, and, you know, all my parents knew was that there were comics in it, and I liked it, and I would just take my copy and run upstairs with it, you know, and they had, you know, National Lampoon had the funny pages with,
Was this when they had, like, Drew Friedman and...
Yeah, Drew Friedman and Gan Wilson.
Yeah.
Who am I thinking of? Shari Flanagan.
Yeah.
Bobby London. People like that. So I enjoyed doing that, reading that, and heavy metal then also, and And I liked some of the science fiction fantasy stuff there, but they, I think, also had a section in the middle that had, like, humor comics, and that's usually what I would go to and read first.
I find with heavy metal, there's some neat stuff, but there's just way too many barbarians.
Yes, exactly right. I always found some of that stuff. I was going to name a name, but I won't do that. But I always found some of that stuff just a little creepy. I was never really one for sort of erotic comics. I couldn't really ever figure out why that, I don't know. It wasn't a huge form of entertainment for me, even as a really horny 14-year-old kid or whatever. I just wasn't, I was like, okay, yeah, boobs, okay, boobs. Ah, here's the funny stuff, So,
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, actually, they might have even have been, at the time, they might have even have been doing that, the horny goof, was that?
The Mobius strip?
Yeah, I think that might have been, like, either being re-serialized, or I don't know how old that is, or whatever, but I think that was actually in there at a while, and that made me laugh too.
Well, that one.
And there
was
some. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That one was just ridiculous. Like that was. I don't even remember.
I remember it being beautifully drawn, nicely colored. I liked looking at it. I'm not sure. I couldn't tell you anything about the story or.
I think that's how it goes with Mobius, though.
Is it?
You look at it; it's beautiful, But
I can't.
After you finish it, do you remember what happened? Not really.
Yeah, no, I can't honestly say I've read anything else by him, but yeah, beautiful artwork and stuff like that. But needless to say, I think if I went back and looked for them, probably stored at my parents' house somewhere in the attic, or I'm sure I could probably find all of my old Mad magazines. I doubt I held on to any of the Heavy Metal or the National Lampoons or anything like that. But I did enjoy them at the time, and they were pretty influential, I think. And they led me to other things, too, because I would read some of the stuff in National Lampoon and then go look in, like, the humor section in the bookstores for gag cartoons. And I think that's how I sort of stumbled on Cliven and things like that. And even The New Yorker, I think, I was getting at a young age. I don't think I probably got most of the humor there, but there were comics in there, and more so than like long form comic books, I think I was always sort of gravitated toward comic strips and comic strip collections and gag cartooning. I probably bought a lot of New Yorker cartoonist collections without really knowing much about the magazine, and then eventually, got a subscription to the magazine or something like that. But I always enjoyed looking at it, and I always enjoyed sort of thinking about how they were writing those gags and the different approaches that the different artists had. I'm afraid I probably can't be more specific than that, but I did enjoy them quite a bit, and probably, even though, like I said, most of it was probably over my head.
Now, for yourself, when doing gags,
sure,
you tend to stick with longer gags than the short.
I've done a lot of both. In fact, I started out trying to be a New Yorker cartoonist. That was really what I would have loved to have done. And I submitted to them for years and years and years. And they had a Wednesday drop-off, and I actually worked around the corner, so every day I would go, and I would drop stuff off. But I never had much luck. I can't even say that I was very good at it, but I did enjoy doing it. And I still enjoy doing, like, just a quick gag cartoon. But, I think that the longer form allows for that denseness and that layering, which I enjoy doing. I enjoy putting that into the work.
Mm-hmm.
So I have sort of gravitated to that over the past few years and stuff, yeah.
Well, you kind of go into, the Evan Dorkin school of a full illustration. Not necessarily as maddening as Evan will get with his, layer of mundane detail.
What's that?
I'm just saying.
I'm sorry, I just didn't follow that one.
Just your own artwork style. It's a lot more complex than a lot of the type of New Yorker stuff, especially
Oh,
I'd say it's kind of like something like with Evan Dorkin.
Right.
You know, with
great
a lot
artist.
Of detail, just without yeah. being as, you know, maddening as, say, someone like Evan Dorkin.
Right. Well, I will say that I actually did sell a cartoon to The New Yorker eventually, and actually was published in The New Yorker. I had a gag cartoon then. You'll just have to go and find that one on your own. It's a lone one. It is included in that big tome of Complete New Yorker. It's on the disc somewhere, so you can look it up if you're interested. But I sort of got... I worked really hard on it for a long time, but I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I couldn't figure out exactly what it was that they were... You know, I would get like sort of a glimmer of hope, and then couldn't figure out why it wasn't working out. And again, it might just be that I wasn't really very good at it. So it's a real, you know, it's a tough thing to do. It really mm-hmm. is. Got a lot of respect for those guys. It's really hard to do and be good at it. So,
well, they have a tight crew, I think, of people that are they've chosen as their...
Yeah, and maybe that was it. I just felt like I was no way I was going to break into that. It just didn't seem doable, I think. And I think around the same time, and I sold some gag cartoons to Spy Magazine and to eventually National Lampoon. So I actually did. But then, like, you know, Spy went under and National Lampoon got bought up and those kind of things sort of dried up. And at the same time, I had a friend mention the Xeric Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I had tons of material I just couldn't do anything with. Nobody was interested in publishing it. So I applied for that and got that in, I don't know, I don't even remember what year that was, but so that was the beginning of the Wiggly Reader then. And I think probably since then I probably have not done much gag cartooning unless something sort of just occurred to me, you know, jot it down, but don't spend a lot of time working on that kind of stuff.
When did you decide to take the cartoonist path?
Oh, well, you know, I'm not sure if I ever really decided that as much as it just sort of happened. You know, I always tell people it's not something I really love to do. It's something that I have a hard time not doing. But I don't know exactly when or if I really made a conscious decision to take that route.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall, like, even in college, people would ask me that, and I'd be like, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. There's absolutely no money in that.
Did you go to art school?
I did. I went to Parsons in New York City.
Okay.
Yeah.
The prestigious Parsons.
What's that?
The prestigious Parsons.
Yeah. I mean, it was a nice school, and I enjoyed it. I met a lot of really great people there, and not sure if I learned as much as I should have, but I don't know if that's necessarily the fault of the school. I spent a lot of time hanging around in the cafeteria. Not much to learn there. Well, actually, no. You'd be surprised.
But, so was it in the illustration area?
Yeah. I majored in illustration, that's right. So concepts and all that kind of stuff. But at the time, I don't believe there was a single course geared toward cartooning.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have taken a humor illustration class, and I had a few teachers that would sort of let you experiment on your own. They had a sort of an open, as long as you were delivering work on critique day, you could almost sort of do whatever you want. And I think I did dabble a little bit in doing some comics, but really, I have to think that it was probably not until after college that I started really working toward making a career out of being a cartoonist, as well as an illustrator. I never gave up on any of that stuff. I always took the jobs, and I enjoy that too. It's a different, totally different thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're working for someone, you know. You're following orders. You're delivering a product for them. And so the comics are much more self-indulgent and maybe a little bit more fun sometimes. Also probably a little more frustrating or maybe just different. But I enjoy doing both of them. You know, they're like different muscles, you know. I'm not sure that I ever really made a conscious decision to be a cartoon. It either was just an innate thing that it was always lurking in the background, or on just under the surface, or I just glided into it and didn't notice.
It's just something that ends up happening.
Yeah, yeah. Do you hear that a lot from people?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I think you'd have to be, you know, you'd sort of have to be nuts to say, oh, that's what I want to do, and knowing that it really is not it's not easy, you know?
The thing I think I see sometimes is where people, like yourself, it's something they're going to do, but it's just, and they hit the reality of how economically feasible is it and stuff. And that's
right.
The challenge where people, that's what they want to do. That's what they, just how to support and live at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, again, it ended up being something I seem to not be able to not do.
Yeah.
There have been many times I was like, all right, this is not working out. I got to find something different to do. And then, you know, it just, you think of something, a good idea for something, like, oh, you know, this will be the one. But still waiting on that. We'll see.
Let's talk about some of your comics.
Okay.
One that I really loved, you sent me a nice package of goodness, is Timberdoodle.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of my my particular faves.
Thanks. That was from a while ago. I think that was nominated for an Ignatz at SPX one year. That's a pretty popular one. A lot of people write to me and ask for that one. I don't know why. It's kind of a bizarre story, but it does have a lot of that layering that we spoke about earlier. Hopefully, you know, I tried to put like three or four jokes on every page. Some of them are way in the background. Some of them are puns. I love puns, bad puns. But it really is just a bunch of silliness with a sort of semi-tragic ending, but it's really just silly. But for some reason, that resonates with people. I don't know why.
Well, you gotta hit, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Why question it?
Now, the Bernard in Petey and Pussy.
Yeah.
He's a tragic man, or tragic bird.
Yeah, he's a bird brain, though. I mean, he's, you know.
You don't have a love for birds, I noticed that.
You know, I had a bird, and whose name I cannot say over the air because it contains profanity, but it had a lot to do with the fact that they poop everywhere. You can't diaper them. I tried. You just can't do it. The thing was a machine. You know, you're like, all right, I won't feed it for a week. And still, no, I'm just kidding. I didn't buy the bird. I inherited it from my sister, who had a bird and then decided that she preferred to have a cat. They didn't get along. So I inherited the bird, and I liked the bird to a degree, but it really got on my nerves. Wake me up in the morning, you know, just, again, that was like 20, 25 years. I can still find poop from that bird. You know, in my parents' house. You just will go, I'm like, oh, they're everywhere. Nook and cranny. It was amazing. So I have no great love for birds, but I don't know if that's really the reason I torture him so much. I don't know. I'm not quite sure. And I'm not sure exactly why that is funny to me, that poor bird is in so much pain. Isn't there like an old saying that it's, comedy is tragedy plus time or distance. Like, if it's, as long as it's happening to somebody else, it's okay. You know, you get smacked in the nuts. Can I say nuts?
Yeah, no, you're in Canada. You can say whatever you want.
Oh, okay. You know, you get smacked in the nuts, not so funny.
Yeah. But,
you know, when you're watching America's Home Video and that guy gets smacked in the nuts, that's hysterical. You know, it hurt him just as much as it hurt you, but for some reason that's fodder for humor, and I think it probably doesn't go much deeper than that. But, I actually do have a little sympathy for Bernie. I mean, I don't think I would enjoy being in a cage, but, and my original plan for him was he was never going to get out. Like, you would never see him outside the cage. I immediately broke that rule in both of the stories I think I've written. But,
but things just go worse when he gets
out. Yeah, that's right. He never seems to get far anyway. So, but a lot of people relate to him for some reason. It's it, there's two things about Petey and Pussy that I always found surprising. That one, he seems to be the most, like, I don't want to say popular, but people are always asking me about him. And the other thing is that, I don't know why this is, but it really surprised me that for some reason a lot of women come up to me at the table and tell me how much they like Petey and Pussy. And I would just, and I guess maybe that's terribly sexist on my, but just, it just seems like it's, like, you wouldn't, why do you like that? You know, you really shouldn't like that. It's mean and it's not nice. And I don't know if it's because they're pets or because they're, you know, bald men. I don't know what it is that attracts to them, but it seems to, it just always catches me by surprise. Anyway.
Well, I guess the neat thing is that you really are able to capture their animal movements.
Oh, you see, that's nice. I appreciate that because I haven't owned a dog in a long time, and I've never owned a cat.
Really?
And I think even in the three stories that are included in the Petey and Pussy book, you can see that in the beginning, they had rubbery legs, and and but in a way, it wasn't sort of working for me. I wanted the animal halves to be really animal-y.
Yeah.
And, you know, just, you know, that's why Pussy's always having trouble with his paws and the constant frustration of, you know, wanting to pick something up, but not...
The peanut jar.
Yeah, not being able to do it. And, you know, there are many recurring themes in Petey and Pussy, and I have many stories written that hopefully will someday see the light of day. And it's a reoccurring theme, this problem of not... that frustration of not being able to do what you're trying to do. I think all the characters in that book have it, sort of. They're not all quite functioning at 100%, needless to say.
Not all the synapses are firing.
No, no.
Well, and that's the thing. The thing I really appreciate is that they're not, and like, I understand what that previous editor was totally saying about the hatred of anthropomorphic animals,
right,
where it's just like, I can't really draw a face, so I'm going to make an animal head.
Is that what it is? Is that how a lot of that stuff comes about?
I think that's it. I think it's someone who wants to do, like, funny animal cartoons and...
Yeah, it doesn't tie into that, like, furry movement. I mean, which is something I'd never heard of before. Bob Fingerman told me about it a long time ago. He was writing a story about it or something.
I know
like
the
that.
Story.
Do you? And I was like, no. And I... You know, I have seen mentions of Petey and Pussy. That group has taken notice. There's something they find that sort of intriguing. I'm not sure why, but yeah.
You're whatever, on the list.
Yeah, and whatever floats your boat, really. I could really care less, but I don't quite understand it myself. But
yeah.
I can't think of any kind of. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I could talk about the absurdity or interest of furries for a while. It's, I had an old friend who, I hadn't seen him a couple years, I went and visited him, and I found out what a furry was pretty quickly. It's like, here's our costumes, the costumes, I sell them online, here's my tail, see this tail's got a weight in it so it wags.
Oh my.
Wags. And then there's the images he draws as well, which are furry porn pictures, and that was like, okay.
Yeah. See, I am not going to. I cannot point fingers. It reminds me of a time I was, and I don't mean to continue the name drop, but I was talking to I was sort of teasing Mike Dawson. Do you know?
Yep.
He did a book, Freddie and Me.
Yeah, he's going to be on in April.
Oh well, he's you'll have fun talking to him. He's a smart guy, very funny, knows a lot about comics and stuff. But I was teasing him one time about the detail and the love and the rendering of the chest hair on Freddie Mercury in Freddie and Me. And you know, and then like I think later on that night I went home and I was still finishing Petey and Pussy and I'm drawing hair on the testicles of a dog. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, that's really not even comparable. I have to call up and apologize. So I'm not gonna badmouth the furries. They're cool in my book.
I took a tramp
into the fourth dimension. 'Cause I had the blues. The blues are throwing it all away. Just give me a tequila. I'll slam it the 4D way. And when I got there, you know, it had certain similarities, like no smoking anywhere and hiding in the car seat to avoid paying the fare. 4D tequila, anyone? And don't think we didn't dance to record by the fifth dimension in the disco sphere, like Kublai Khan. And it was pretty goddamn hazardous out on the Ilminster bypass. Out on the Ilminster bypass. Out on the Ilminster bypass.
Out on the Ilminster bypass.
Back foot cleaning to the theme park. Well, are we spewed inside, back and forth, in time, mathematics, and pride, inside, we've gone Vulcan. Absolutely has to happen to someone.
Yeah,
today.
There's no smoking anywhere.
Throw it all away.
Yeah, we've got smoking anywhere.
You can get rid of the blues this way.
Yeah, that's how the place to blues today.
It absolutely has to happen.
Tell me about the I guess the pet owner of of Pussy.
The old lady.
The old lady that likes to make use of her fridge.
Yeah, that's right. Well, she's it's funny because a lot of people don't ask me about her. I think maybe they're just afraid.
She's and it's funny, you're talking about like sexuality in comics, and like this is one of the most it's the most, I guess it's like, you know, well, it's naked old women. It's,
Here's my take on that, where that comes from, is that, you know, I try in my humor to not be mean to any particular group, or it just doesn't drive me as a cartoonist to, you know, I don't know, make fun of people. And I was always afraid, you know, people, that's really not nice about old people. You're really making fun of, because really that problem, that lady's story is she's just old and a little bit senile. There's really not much more wrong with her. She's drunk and she's horny all the time. But I mean, I don't know. I'm drunk and horny most of the time too. But no, that's terrible. But you know what I mean. And the way I sort of justify sort of having fun with somebody who's senile and old is that I'm hoping I get there too. You know, at some point, you know, I keep making references with her that she once dated Abraham Lincoln, trying to you know, she's got the hots for Abe, and she's always talking about Abe, and don't get near me, Abe, you know. I'm trying to establish the fact that she's very old, very, very old. And, you know, the fact that she's even walking around is, you know, cause for celebration. But in a way, I think I established that character because, again, in the beginning, and these things change as you work on them, I never planned to address the issue of PD and Pussy's and Bernie's peculiarity.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed a home base for Pussy. And PD's a stray. He lives on the streets. And I
poor
needed
guy.
What's that?
Poor guy.
Yeah. And I needed somebody who wasn't going to acknowledge or react to it. And for the most part, I just ignore it. Because I have no real reason for them to be the way they are. There is no real... They just are. And so that is why I sort of established his home base as, you know, being run by this person who... And I also liked the idea that Pussy really was running the household.
Yeah.
Which you don't get a real glimpse of in these few stories that I've done, but, again, I hope to establish it in some later stories that you'll see he's... You know, how does that woman get by? It's because he does a lot, you know. He also is not very helpful in a lot of other ways. But that was the deal. But again, I sort of justify it, at least to myself, in the sense that you know, I hope to be old, you know, someday soon, too. Well, not someday soon, but, you know, someday, too, that I'll grow old. And so I'm sort of just making fun of someplace I'll be in a few years. So.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right.
I think so.
Well, I'm just going to keep telling myself that anyway, so.
Oh, it's a tragic household.
Yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit about the Wiggly Reader.
Sure.
Your three issues total, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
The Zurich Foundation paid for the first two. I had sent the original, the application or my original proposal to them was to do three issues. And I think they gave me the money for three issues, and I was not able to complete them, in a decent enough time. And you have to sort of use the money before a certain time, or you lose it. And so what I did was I ended up just making the first two issues a little bigger. They were going to be 24-page comics. I think they're all 32. And then did the first two, and then with the proceeds of the first two, funded the third one. But that's when the money ran out. So, but I was pretty grateful for that. They were, you know, really, if you're an aspiring cartoonist, it's the way to go. Are they open to international cartoonists? Can you apply from Canada to the Zurich Foundation? Do they care where you?
I had some friends that did.
Okay, so there you go.
I don't know. None of them got it, but
I can. It was a while ago, so maybe it's changed, but. Man, the process was so easy, and they're so helpful. It's really a nice thing to do and a way to go because it's hard. The only problem that I really faced was just distribution. Once the comics were done and printed and everything, I really didn't have a good way of getting them to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that really, I think that's probably what ended that run. More than anything else, even the money-wise. If I had been able to just get them out into stores on a regular basis or, you know, a reliable basis, I would have kept doing it, even if it had meant just being an expensive hobby for myself. But it really was fruit, but you just couldn't do it.
It seems like you put a lot of work into your comic, so you wouldn't be able to do a regular thing at this volume of material.
Well, I do. I have sort of a really... we don't need to go into it in any detail, but I have a laborious way of working. Is that the right word? Is that a word at all?
And actually, detail's good because some people are actually pretty fascinated by how other people put their comics together.
It takes me a long time. I'm very... So I am not... I don't consider myself to be like a fantastic draftsman. I can't... You know, people ask me for sketches, and I have a tendency to draw the same picture of myself, which doesn't even look like me, really. And I've had people go, oh, they'll come and ask you for a sketch, and you're doing it, and they'll have people go, oh, that guy again? You know, and I'm like, That's me.
Hey!
Oh, I know how to draw. But I panic when people ask me to draw a drawing of Petey and Pussy for them because, you know, I'm kind of one of those erase, you know, and to do a little quick sketches. But it's gone to the point where now I think I need to even maybe find a different way of working because it's too slow. It's just I can't put that amount of time into the work. But you know, it's like all these other things we've been talking about. It's not really even a conscious approach. I'm just drawing until it looks done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm drawn to other people's work that has a lot of detail and little things to look at, and I love to pore over. The other day in the New York Times Magazine, there was a cross section of a cruise liner, you know, like an advertisement for a cruise liner that there was like a cutaway. And it was this I'm like, oh my god! And I tore it out, and I'm like, I got to put this on my wall. And I'm looking, I'm like, what are you nuts? Throw that away, you know. But I loved looking at all the little. Look at those little seats in that little auditorium there, you know. Mental, just totally mental. But I enjoy that in other people's work, and sort of enjoy putting it into my own.
You should read some Dan Zetwalk comics then.
Oh, he's great. He's great. I enjoy, and the thing I love now is the thing, and I don't read a lot of comics. I got to tell you, probably more now than ever in my life. But I don't read a lot. But I do really enjoy the strip, the Leon Beyond strip that he's doing with Kevin Huizenga, and I think maybe Ted May might be doing them too.
Yeah.
Those things crack me up. I had the opportunity to talk to Kevin at I think at SPX, and I was telling him how, and this is kind of embarrassing, but like when they first started doing them, I'm reading them and I'm going, no, that can't be true. Totally, totally missing the point that they were, you know. And after I read like five, I'm like, oh, okay, I get you. I think he actually took a little bit of pleasure in that. You know, I'm not stupid, but I just, they were done so cleverly that, but those are enjoyable. But I do. I like Dan's, like, he does, like, diagram kind of stuff. I enjoy that kind of stuff a lot. Yeah. It's very good.
Now, I was just looking through the stack of comics here, and the Weekly Reader number 2.
Yeah.
The Abe Lincoln.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular predilection towards Abe? Because we were just talking about the old lady.
Yeah.
Who had her...
You know, if I do, it's a subconscious thing. I don't know if I have a favorite president. but I guess he'd be up there. This is another thing where I cannot recall, probably because I just didn't at the time think it was all that important to make a mental note of it, but I don't recall where the idea for that came from. I really don't. I know that my theory or my approach, I guess, when doing those, all of the Wiggly Reader covers was that, you know, I'm not a designer. I don't fancy myself being some sort of graphic designer. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to just undesign. There's going to be like no design other than a logo. I'll just do a big drawing and wrap it around the cover and hopefully make like a little gag out of it. And I don't know if there was anything more than that. I enjoyed painting that cover quite a bit and drawing it quite a bit. Again, it's one of those scenes that has tons and tons of stuff going on in it. But I'm afraid I probably, and not that, I don't even know if that was your question, but I can't even tell you where that possibly came from or, I think other than those two instances, the old woman's dating history and that cover, I think I've managed to stay away from Abe Lincoln and most of my other stuff, but I'm young yet, so I don't know. We'll see.
That's okay. It would be, I'd be happy to see more Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. My guess is probably I saw something on TV or something like that. You know, it's just something minor.
The Civil War documentary again.
Exactly right. Or you know, something about his assassination or something. That's what happened. That's exactly what happened with that homecoming story that I sent you. I think I sent you that about the salmon swimming.
Yeah.
I just was watching TV and there was a documentary on salmon swimming upstream. I'm like, oh, that's kind of funny. what a terrible and it was like one of those nature shows where they imbue the fish with sort of human qualities. Do you know what I mean? To sort of dramatize the that
they're anthropomorphizing.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, you know. I would imagine that the Abe Lincoln cover was probably came about in some sort of similar fashion.
Now, the fish story you're talking about, that was in your collection, The Drunk Drawer. Is that still available for folks?
I don't think it is in that. It's just a standalone. That was just a standalone mini comic. I don't think I included it in
Just not in my stack of stuff I brought with me today.
Yeah, but the junk drawer, I have a few of them. I only made about 100 of those, and the plan was to make 200, and at some point I think my wife came into my studio and saw me crying and said, you don't have to make that many, you know. It was brutal. I will never do that again.
Well, that's quite the process you have there, the fold-over pages, the cardboard cover.
Yeah, and to a degree, I really enjoy making mini comics and stuff, although I often liken it to, like, a 40-year-old man's version of a lemonade stand, you know, only that I would make more money selling lemonade, you know, but that's sort of what it feels like. Sometimes when I'm sitting on the floor with a big stapler and a paper cut, I'm going, how old am I again? Wait a minute. You know, like...
Yeah.
But I do enjoy... I do enjoy making those books. I enjoy the craft of them, and I try and make them nice and add a little something to them. So, again, not a huge designer, so I'm not sure a lot of them are very pretty, but it's not for lack of effort, I think.
Well, I love the one with the snowman nose.
Yeah, thanks.
The cadeau carrot.
Thanks. So. Yeah, that was a Christmas card I sent out to people one year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's a lovely Christmas card.
Thanks.
It makes good as a Christmas card. Now, Petey and Pussy just came out a couple months ago. What's the next thing you're working on? Is it more Petey and Pussy?
Well, I do. I have more Petey and Pussy stories to work on. I haven't committed myself to doing anything yet. So I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to pick up next. I have a lot of comic stories to work on. I think I'm going to take a little bit of a deep breath because I recently finished a big project for the museum.
That's right. Talk about that a little. That's pretty neat.
It's not really comics, I guess, but it took a long time. I worked on that for about 4 years, and exclusively, but for the better part of 4 years, and it was a lot of work. And so I was just in the, I finished it just before the holidays of this past year. So I was planning on just taking a little bit of breather, cleaning up my studio a little bit. You know, going through, I've collected a lot of stuff to work on over the past 4 years, ideas and little beginnings of little stories, but so I'm looking at different things. I'm actually considering doing a newspaper strip, a syndicated strip, and doing that for a little while. I always enjoyed the newspapers. You know, the only problem is this is not a really great time for newspapers. So,
no.
But, it's not a really great time for anything. It's not a really great time to come out with a new comic book either. It's tough. Well, it's just the reality of the situation. So I think I'm going to take a little bit of a breather and then follow through on some of these projects that I've been sitting on my desk while I've been tackling that poster.
Well, for now, people can check out various comic strips on your website.
Yep, FontenellePress.com. That's right.
Yep, and Petey and Pussy from Fantagraphics.
Yep.
And much more.
Yeah, more to come. Stay tuned.
Will you be at comic conventions like MoCA and SPX and things like that?
I've gotten shut out of MoCA the last couple of years.
What?
I haven't been able to get... I had a little well, it doesn't really matter, but I missed a year and then had trouble getting back in, and I've been on the waiting list and stuff. I felt terrible about it, and then I think this past year I went, and Jason Shiga had a table set up outside the Puck building to sell his comic. And I was like, you go. And I sort of didn't feel so bad. I'm like, if this guy can't get in, you know, he's
Eisner nominated.
What's that?
He got nominated for an Eisner.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. If this guy's got to peddle his stuff out on the sidewalk, I should not feel so bad. So, but I'm hoping now that they're moving to a bigger place that I will be able to get in there. It's, you know, it'd be nice to be able to go to the convention that's in your own backyard.
Yeah.
This past year I did SPX. I hadn't done that in about 4 years, and I enjoyed that quite a bit. I hadn't been to that new location, but that was pretty nice, I thought. And I'd like to go back to that, but we'll see. You know, the conventions are hard to do when you don't have something new to sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fans, they want to see something new. So a lot of it will depend on if I've got something to sell.
All right. Well, you got PD and Pussy.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
I do know it's in stores.
Yeah, it is. Somewhere.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Robin, it was a real pleasure. I appreciate being on.
It's well to talk to you, John, and I hope you have a swell day.
All right. Thanks so very much.
Thank you so much.
All right. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
That was John Kirschbaum. His book is PD and Pussy, as well as his comic was a weekly reader, and he has a whole bunch of other stuff. You can check on his website, fontanellepress.com. With a lovely logo of a man pushing his, or a hand pushing its finger into a skull. If you do not know what a fontanelle is, please Google it. Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. And, yeah, thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye. This is InkSense on CITR 101.9 FM. My guest for this interview is Durf, author of Punk Rock in Trailer Parks, as well as an assortment of other books, including High School with Dahmer, or My Life with Dahmer.
My Friend Dahmer.
My Friend Dahmer. Did you actually go to high school with him?
Yes, I did.
Okay. We'll get into that a little later.
Everybody does.
What can you, you know, it's a curious subject.
Well, it's my brush with greatness. That's okay.
If you want to call it that. Maybe we'll use another term. Punk Rock Trailer Parks, I guess it's a bit of a love song of a comic to the early days of Americana punk rock. Is that a good way of putting it?
Well, yeah, pretty gritty love song. I mean, I'm not
it's punk rock.
I'm not known as a sentimentalist, so But yeah, you know, it's a fictional piece. First of all, it's not nonfiction, and yeah, it's sort of a Rust Belt ode to punk rock.
Well, I felt a little sentimental because it seems all the people you feature in it have all passed away.
Oh well, yeah. There's a number of guest stars that come through the book. For those of you who haven't read it, like Joe Strummer and Wendy O. Williams of the Plasmatics and Lester Bangs. And it actually didn't start out that way. I was like halfway through writing it, and I noticed that all the people I was putting in to the book, who were people that were my personal favorites, that were all gone. Mm-hmm. And after that, I just decided, well, I'll just make them all dead. So I only used after that, I only used ones who had passed away. And it wasn't hard to come up with it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Either that means we're, you know, I'm getting old, or it was a pretty tough lifestyle. I suspect it's a little of both.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the latter. You know.
Right.
These folks died of, you know, various rough illnesses. It wasn't like...
Well, except Wendy. She offed herself. And
well, that's a rough way to...
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, you can also argue heroin addiction and whatnot, too.
Right, sure.
How did you first get into Yule punk rock?
Well, I was a first generation punk rocker. So, I mean, you know, I was a kid. I was just right out of high school, but I took to it right away, you know, for the usual reasons. You know, it was my first foray into the counterculture, and it was a blast. And so I've always, even though my musical tastes since then have, you know, expanded greatly, I still have a soft spot for stuff that's loud and raw.
Beyond the initial three chords.
Right, sure. Yeah, it has expanded beyond that. And, you know, it's a fascinating time, and it's something that hasn't really been touched on a lot, especially in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, where I set the book, which is the unlikely city of Akron, Ohio, the Rubber City, yeah, which at the time had a huge punk rock scene, which has now been largely forgotten. But it was, you know, Devo and Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders and the Waitresses and so many other bands that Melody Maker magazine actually called in 1979, which is ridiculous to think of now. But at the time, it was huge, and it all revolved around this one punk club, which is one of the most famous punk clubs ever, called The Bank, which was just that. It was an old abandoned bank. I mean, it still had the vault in the middle of it and, you know, all the trappings of an old bank. And it was converted into a punk club.
Instead of the normal old blues bars. And...
Right. No. This was complete. It was great. It was a great setting for what was going on with punk. You know, that whole nihilism thing, that whole, you know, it's the end of the American dream. And it was, of course, in the Rust Belt because the factories were closing and everybody was splitting and, you know, pretty much where we are now. And so it was a great setting for this sort of, you know, this caterwaul that was coming out of this club.
Mm-hmm. What was the first punk record that really blew your mind?
The first one is probably the Ramones' first album, just like anybody else. Though I didn't hear it when it first came out, it was shortly after. And I was really into the stiff stuff, too. You know, stiff records, they put out a lot of the early bands like the Pogues and Elvis Costello and Devo.
Mm-hmm.
It was great stuff.
Have you heard Devo 2.0?
Well, they were just in town. I'd heard them then.
The 2.0 one?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the 2.0. No, I haven't heard Devo 2.0.
It's this poppy cover band that, Mothers Bow approved of and helped put together, I think, or helped produce, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's teenagers.
Yeah, no, the original was fine. Beyond that, you know.
I know there was, there's a couple of shows that I've heard that people have gone to. Recent Devo, I think, where they were blown away.
Right, no, yeah, that they were just in town. And, yeah, I mean, they're very large now, but they still put on a great show.
Not wearing the costumes as
they do wear the costumes, actually. They still have the energy domes and the white suit and the yellow suits, all in XXL.
When I saw Kraftwerk a couple of years ago, and that's kind of a similar thing. All these old German guys with these.
Well, yeah, they're German. So, well, of course, mostly, you know, the guys from Devo are all Middle Europeans from Akron too. Same gene pool. It doesn't hold up well.
Now, in how do you, you know, writers include themselves in their works, and what kind of characters in punk rock and trailer parks do you see kind of yourself in?
No, well, this is an exception because I did not put myself in punk rock and trailer parks purposely, because my first two books were both memoir. Mm-hmm. So I was in the first two books, and when I approached this one, I was determined it was going to be fiction, and it was not going to be about me. It was not going to be about my life. So, I mean, my protagonist is named Otto, who's this larger than life figure, and he's, you know, the exact opposite of me. I mean, he's an extrovert. He's fearless. He seizes the moment, and that was by design.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anyone like the Baron back in the day?
Well, I think everybody knows somebody like the Baron, but he's a fairly unique individual. And that's where I started with the book. I started with that character. I'd come up with that character because when I was thinking about, you know, what to write about, the geek is, you know, sort of the staple of comics and certainly the staple of indie comics. And it's kind of tiresome, especially this sort of, you know, self-hating, wretched individual, woe is me, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do something like that. But what I hadn't seen was someone I run into quite a bit. I just call him the narcissistic geek, you know, the guy who thinks he's a rock star, who thinks he's a god. And these are the guys who are running the world now, for better or worse. And right now it's for worse. You know, the Bill Gates types and things like that. So that's where I started.
He definitely has that the proud inner geekisms, especially with the oft-quoted Tolkien.
Right, right. Which,
definitely gives me that feeling of right in the 70s. The, you know. Would you play Dungeons & Dragons, or is that too early?
I think it's a little early,
a little
yeah.
Early.
Yeah, there were probably a few out, but that was the front end of it. I don't remember that being on my radar screen.
Maybe it's for the
thank God. As if I wasn't dork enough for being a comics nut.
What kind of comics did you read as a youngin?
Well, I mean, started out with superhero stuff like everybody else, and then somewhere around the mid 70s I got my mitts on some underground stuff, and you know, the things that were being done in National Lampoon, that was all great. Those are some great comics in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like the reference to National Lampoon in the book. The,
oh, right, right.
The guaranteed certain amount of breasts per
exactly,
per issue.
Exactly. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, horny young teenagers before the internet had it tougher than, you know, kids now. And you can just type in boobs and you've got, you know,
boobs.
50,000 Google hits.
I was trying to explain in a class the other day to some fellow students. I'm a couple of years older than most of the other people in class, and they're talking about how, you know, the internet, has it really changed anything? I'm like, you know, I remember the day when I had these German guys come and stay with me, and they gave me this tape of this awesome German band, and I loved it, and I had to track down more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was hard because someone knew a little bit of it, and you kind of gathered what you could, and now you can just download the whole discography.
Right,
know,
right.
And like, you know?
It's made it a lot easier to find stuff. It just made it a lot harder to actually make a living at it.
For everyone.
Right, because everything's free.
Except for the tours, I guess. So you got into undergrounds.
Right.
Who are some of your underground interests?
Well, Crumb, of course.
Yeah.
Von Baudet. I always liked Bill Griffith and Spain Rodriguez. And then later on, you know,
Spain's from Cleveland, isn't he?
Who?
Spain. He's from Cleveland, I think.
No.
Oh, where is
he? No, he's from California. Crumb lived here for a while.
No, Spain's
but he hated
originally
it.
from the East Coast.
Who?
Spain. Crumb.
Crumb was from Philly, I think.
No, but Spain's from the East Coast originally.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Probably New York.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember.
I don't know. I'm not up on my trivia.
That's okay.
You're the expert. What were we talking about? Oh, undergrounds, and then. then some of the post-punk guys, like, or actually the full-blown punk guys, like John Holmstrom, who was the art director of Punk Magazine, and Mark Merrick, and guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lost interest. Right about the time I really got into music, I lost interest in comics for a while.
What, did you, like, do something else before going and doing comics and doing a comic strip, or, like...
Well, I started out life as a political cartoonist.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, like, one of the mainstream, though I was never really very mainstream, as you can imagine, it didn't work out very well. In fact, I was fired for, as the editor put it, general tastelessness.
Well, it doesn't take much to offend people.
Well, I have a particular gift for it, too. And then I wandered off to the weekly press, you know, the weekly papers that you used to see stacked up in front of coffee shops all over any major big city.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started my strip, which is called The City. And that's been going on for, like, 19 years.
Wow. I haven't read The City. Tell me about it.
Well, it's just that. I mean, it's a weekly strip about being a urban hipster and, you know, everything that revolves around that. So it's kind of free form. It's, you know, there's some politics in there. It's whatever pops into my head. And it runs in weekly papers all over, so they're fading fast.
Any particular places people could check it out?
If
they still read.
Right, right. Cleveland, Dallas, Houston, Miami, Tucson, Kansas City, on and on and on, Cincinnati.
So fair distribution.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, newspapers are on the rocks, so it's fading fast.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide to go into doing longer comics like the Punk Rock and Trailer Parks and the...
Well, I've always had an interest in it. You know, I just never had a lot of time, and I was making a decent living doing the strip. And I think it was the first piece I did was My Friend Dahmer. And I started working on that in the mid-90s. And I found it a lot harder than I thought it would be to sort of cross over, you know. Comic books are a very incestuous little world, and it seems like you got to be part of the club, or there are people who are really just won't let you in. It was really kind of bizarre. Considering that, you know, 90% of comic books are absolute crap, and, you know, I'm certainly capable of doing crap like anybody else, so why not give me a chance? But with Dahmer, I actually had to publish Dahmer myself.
Really?
And it was nominated for an Eisner, so that's kind of opened the door.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I wasn't very familiar with your work until you contacted me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed Punk Rock and Trailer Parks.
Oh, thanks.
I checked out the site and saw the Dahmer thing, and I read the pages that were on there, and I was like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, that was that's actually being redone. I have an offer to do that as a full-blown graphic novel.
Really?
And I'm probably going to do it because, you know, it's such a compelling story.
It is. It was fascinating. I was really interested because it's... From the pages I was reading, it wasn't like you were trying to kind of place a judgment as much as going, this is the guy I went to high school with.
Right.
This is...
It's actually a fairly sympathetic portrait of him.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people have trouble getting their heads around, but I think that's the point of the book, is that, you know, when you make somebody a monster, that's an easy out.
Yeah. And, but what made the monster?
Right.
The question.
There's a reason people become, and maybe you can't figure it out, but in Dahmer's case, at every point in his spiral into madness, which was fairly quick over the course of maybe 3 years of high school,
mm-hmm.
The adults in his life failed him. And they either didn't notice what was going on, or they convinced themselves there was nothing wrong. And, you know, it was just every single one, teachers, administrators, parents, whoever. And that's the lesson that, you know, I think is there. And it's a very dark story, obviously. It's nothing like Punk Rock and Trailer Parks or anything else I do. But it's a good story. And it's gotten a lot of attention. So I really would like the opportunity to do it right. As I said, because it was self-published, that, you know, I had to make a lot of compromises. And also because it was the first longer piece I ever did.
Yeah, you weren't quite as fleshed out as far
as... Right, exactly. And now, you know, with a couple more graphic novels under my belt, I feel that, well, now's the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, I'd be really interested in reading kind of more in-depth.
Well, I got a lot of stuff I left out, and of course a lot of stuff I've discovered since I wrote the book. And, yeah, it's a creepy story.
Have you been kind of contacting your former school?
Oh, yeah, we've always been in contact. In fact, we just had a reunion.
Uh-huh.
So I've heard a lot of, you know, different stories and got photos. And actually a buddy of mine, an acquaintance of mine, actually bought Dahmer's house.
Really?
I tried to talk him out of it, but...
Didn't he live in an apartment when everything went down?
No, that was in Milwaukee.
Okay.
See, here, he grew up here, and he killed his first victim in that house.
Oh, wow.
And then the majority of his unspeakable crimes are committed in Milwaukee. And mm-hmm. that building's gone. It's been torn down.
Yeah. Horrible, horrible stuff. I'm really fascinated, especially by the, I guess, the mimicking kind of pseudo-retarded.
Yeah, he had, he would sort of fake epileptic fits and mimic the slurred speech of his interior decorator, actually his mom's interior decorator, who had cerebral palsy. You know, and we all found this extremely funny,
yeah.
Which, you know, only 17-year-old teenagers can do. I make no apologies for that, you know, I mean, come on, we were kids and, you know, we didn't know.
I still do stuff now that would disgust people.
Right. The most common thing I hear, you know, from some people is like, well, you know, why didn't you get him help? Why didn't you kids speak up? And, you know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, 2008. It was 1978.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we didn't even know about substance abuse. That term didn't even exist yet. You know, to us, it was just called partying, and everybody did it.
It's like that part in Wayne's World where the guy's just partied too much.
Right.
Sorry for the terrible reference there.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it was just a different mindset. And the one thing you never did was narc on a pal. Never, ever.
No.
So, you know, I find that a lot of people want to judge something that happened, you know, 30 years ago mindset, and it just doesn't work. So you just have to kind of accept that for what it was when you read the book. But
I'll look forward to it.
Well, it's a ways away, but
yeah.
I'm working on it. I'm plugging away on it.
Let's talk a little bit more punk rock.
Okay.
What are some? What do you think? Some seminal punk rock albums to you?
Well, the Ramones' first three albums are really the ones that started it all. There were a couple early ones than that, like, you know, Iggy and the Stooges or New York Dolls. I'm not a big Dolls fan, though I understand they were great live. Their records stink.
Yeah, no, I don't like the Dolls much either.
Yeah.
But apparently, I read this great interview with one of the guys from Suicide talking about how they'd play the same space as the Dolls.
Yeah.
Like in this, like, you know, just weird space and be in another room and they'd see all the hot women going to go see the Dolls. And here would be these two guys, one guy with a keyboard, one guy just screaming. And
yeah. The Dolls reunited. They're actually not bad.
Yeah, but there's only, like,
two
of them.
There's only two
of
them,
alive.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, all the others are dead. After that, you know, the Clash. I mean, their first four. Well, I'm really a huge Clash fan, so virtually everything they did, except the last one.
That's the double disc.
No, the last one was Cut the Crap when half the band was gone. Not a good album, but other
they were just left with the crap.
Yeah, right. Actually, somebody just gave me a bootleg of the Clash's concert that they played in Akron, which I put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty happy to get that. It sounds terrible on the bootleg. So, I mean, it's, you know, you have this memory of this being this, you know, sort of searing performance, and I don't know. The boot doesn't sound that great.
No, I doubt they had mini disc recorders or digital recorders at that.
Well,
they
recorded it from the board.
Oh, really?
So it doesn't sound that bad, but it just, you know, it doesn't capture it, at least my memory of it. So the new live disc they just put out, the Shea Stadium one, does. I mean, that sounds great. Now, God knows what they did to that in the, you know, in the
cleanup,
right? The production booth, but it sounds it sounds just fabulous.
No, I was I've got a big soft spot for the Clash, and I was very sad when Joe Strummer passed away.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a real shocker.
You know, like out of I love a lot of punk rock stuff, but he was like the one guy who was actually like really into what he was doing.
Yeah,
like, there was like actually stuff going behind it. I mean, the Ramones are fun, and I know you've got a big thing for the Ramones, but I mean, they were
morons. I mean,
they were
yeah.
they had a routine. They did a routine. It was like at a certain point they became like a boys band version of a punk band, where they they had a stage show that went exactly this way.
Right,
it doesn't seem as electric to me.
Right. Well, no. So I have to say, I never saw a bad show by the Ramones. But yeah, I mean, after the first 4 years, they were pretty much done, and they knew that. I mean, they admit as much. After that, it was just a job to them.
Yeah.
They didn't grow anymore after that. I don't think they had the intellectual capacity to really grow as artists. I mean, they were what they were.
Yeah.
And they were, they were proud of that, and God bless them.
Mm-hmm.
But Strummer was, Strummer was more. I mean, he was a big mind, and so was Patti Smith, and so were Devo, for that matter.
Yeah.
So it was a real, it was a real mixed bag. But for just sheer raw power, I mean, you can't beat a Ramones show circa 1977. It was amazing.
Lester Bangs.
Sure.
Do you read a lot of his stuff?
I did. I had a subscription to Cream in the mid-70s, back when I was just a young toad. And I lived out in the boonies, outside of, in a little farm town outside of Akron, which might as well have been Mayberry.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was really hard to find, again, before the internet, to find access to anything that was in the counterculture. And somehow someone must have clued me in. I got a subscription to Cream, and immediately Lester Bangs stuff just popped out of there, and it's like, wow, this guy is amazing. And he led me to Iggy, and through Iggy, pretty much everything else. Lou Reed, stuff like that.
MC5.
Yeah, I was never really into the MC5. I mean, their records really sound awful. I like them now. I mean, they're terrific. But, at the time, you hear those recordings and you just go, oh, this is mud. And they admit as much. I mean, that they were not helped by their engineer.
No. I wish they did a tour with a different singer while the other guy's dead, but...
Yeah.
And I heard that was fantastic. Oh, yeah, it was Evan Dando, wasn't it, from the Lemonheads?
Yeah, I think it was, actually. I didn't see that. I've seen Wayne Kramer play, but I didn't see the MC5 reunion. Virtually everybody has reunited at one point or another.
I've enjoyed the Stooges stuff that I've heard.
Yeah, no, the Stooges sound great.
But
and
I mean,
Rocket from the Tombs got back together, and they were fabulous. So, you never know when these reunion tours are gonna be great or when they're just gonna stink, and you just kinda gotta roll the dice.
Well, the Stooges, they got Mike Watt on to
play bass,
so it's like,
well, as long as they got Iggy, they're fine.
Yeah.
And
as long as they haven't been practicing too much,
exactly. So they can't really replicate, the heroin highs they were on.
Now, one thing I was really surprised about was the immediate inclusion of Klaus Nomi.
Mm. Now, that is actually, that's one of the exceptions to the book. That actually did happen. He did play Akron. He did play the bank. And it was a really memorable show. It was just so, in my mind, it was just so quintessentially of that era and of that place, because when you think of punk, you think, well, it's a very doctrinaire. It has to be this. It's a very closed little system. But that wasn't the case at all. I mean, you were pulling in all sorts of music from across the spectrum. It was really kind of the music industry that divided things up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a fan. I mean, if it was new, we were into it. So, and Klaus Nomi was definitely... fit into that category, and I really urge everyone to go check out the YouTube clips of Nomi, because he's really kind of just he's indescribable.
I think there's this one when Bowie played
Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
Klaus did was on stage with them.
Yep. Yeah, Klaus and his boyfriend.
And they carried Bowie on stage in this weird plaster.
Right. Yeah, it was like a big flower pot.
Very memorable. Very easy to YouTube. Tell me about some of the characters in one that really I loved was the schizophrenic guy in the trailer park.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I grew up in a small town, so you know, one of the things I wanted to do with this book was divide it up between this punk club, which obviously would be very counterculture, and then this small town where Otto lives. And I like the contrast there, but you know, there's a lot of similarities because you get just whack jobs in both places, but they're different kinds of whack jobs. And because I was my second graphic novel, which is Trashed, is the memoir of my career as a garbage man, which was spent in my hometown, and so I got to know all these bizarre individuals, and just kind of wrote them down over the years, and just was saving them, and I just threw everything into this book, you know, everything I had in my sketchbook that I hadn't used before, it's in there. And so a lot of the small town stuff was really, I really wanted to get it in. And this guy, the schizophrenic guy who lives in the trailer park, doesn't take his meds. He barks at the neighbors, and at one point he takes his parents hostage. I won't give away what happens, but it doesn't end badly. It's I think a pretty funny sequence. And you know, when you live in a small town, you run into people like this all the time. Every town has one. Some guy that wigs out, if not three or four guys that wig out, and who live at home until they're 50 and, you know, talk to trees.
The local madman.
Right.
No, one place I used to live in, it's in the middle of the city in Vancouver, in our ghetto neighborhood in the downtown east side, and we had one guy every day at 4:30 would meow.
Cool.
And it was just like, you know, it's the meow hour.
Right, right.
And then in Christmas, or during the winter, you know, or before Christmas, every day, I think that same guy would just go, Merry fucking Christmas! And then just keep going. I miss that, living in my new gentrified neighborhood.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, the yuppie neighborhoods, they just don't have the color.
No, it's...
They just don't have it.
No, all they have is coffee shops and pedicure.
Well, we don't even have that. We don't have much of anything anymore. Actually, my small town is now all McMansions, so all the yuppies moved in. You know.
That's okay. They're probably all foreclosed.
Bankrupt,
now,
yeah, too. I know. There's a lot of foreclosures, yeah.
It's amazing looking at all the stuff that's happening down there, because we're not really feeling it the way it's hitting American.
Right.
You know, it's...
Give it time, you will.
I live in the Olympic City, so...
Vancouver may be a little immune, because that's, yeah. But, man,
no, we're
everybody else is feeling it, you know. Go to Iceland or...
Iceland's just scary.
Japan or anywhere. I mean, it's just like all of Europe is just one economy crashing after another.
Well, Japan's been crashing for a while, too, I think.
Right, right. So we're back in the 70s again, you know. It's a recession again. What a jip.
Oil's all involved, you know, not going well, and
you know, it's of course perfect timing on my part that I release a graphic novel just as the economy goes in the toilet. That's sort of a classic career move for me. And you know, comics are, you know, a lot of the comics publishers are really on the rocks right now too.
Yeah, no, even I think your publisher, Slave Labor Graphics, aka Amazing Inc., they're feeling the pinch with the new distributor quotas, and because
that's a real drag.
They're one of the few that still actually publish, you know, separate comics. Don't just
right.
live off the graphic novel market, as people like to call it, which I go, it's just a comic, only longer.
Right. Big ass comics, I call them.
Yeah, there we go. I'm fine with that.
Right.
So, well, I look forward to your eventual Dahmer, and I very much enjoyed Punk Rock and Trailer Parks.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. It's gotten good reviews, so
it's
hopefully.
Fun. You know, it's a fun read.
No, it's a good read. It's just a good yarn. That was my goal going into it, and hopefully I accomplished that. I mean, it's, you know, I There's nothing wrong with that. And especially now, we need, you know, comics to lighten the mood. And you can always burn them for heat if times really get tough.
Exactly. And it's not a thin book.
You know? No, it'll burn for a good 10 minutes.
Newsprint, it's good for starting the fire.
That's right.
Please do not burn comics. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Durf.
Thanks, Robin.
That was Durf. His book is Punk Rock and Trailer Parks, as well as the ongoing strip in many weekly alternative papers around America called The City. And check them out. I'll post the link on the websites, inkstuds.com, CITR 101.9 FM.
One, two, be stiff!